Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chen Baker.
Hello.
Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the human-sized cloche that is our recording studio and dissect three different links that we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping-off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the perils of government-funded arts organizations, what happens when clients sue their ad agencies, and the structure of trust. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest, Emily Naismith. Emily is a writer, creator, and strategist. She hosts the food podcast Ingredipedia, which has been listed by The Age as one of the top Australian podcasts, and writes columns on Broadsheet called Snack Detective and Food We Fight About. Currently, she is the director of branded content at Broadsheet Studio, which was just named Branded Content Studio of the Year at the Mumbrella Publish Awards. She's also worked in the creative department of Clemenger BBDO Melbourne and for publications including Life Lounge and The Thousands. Recently, she's worked on campaigns for Disney, Mercedes, NAB, and the AFL, among many more. And we are so happy to welcome her to the studio today. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I am so into how into food you are.
Yeah, pretty obsessed.
It's very good. It makes me very happy. I just had like a kind of disappointing lunch. More on that later. But anyway, I just knew you'd like understand. How are you going, Jeremy?
I'm okay. You know, I found out that we're the number 15 podcast in the arts and design podcast. And maybe
found
and
out trending up. Because I sent that screenshot to you?
Okay. You know what? Actually, the reason you got that screenshot is because I found that app on Product Hunt. I signed up for it. And then their marketing channel reversed and sent it to me.
Right,
it always starts with the boss.
Oh, but yes, we're number 15 in Australian arts and design podcast. It might be number 15 out of 15, but I'm okay with it. I'm
okay
excited.
At least we got something to aim for.
Yeah.
And then
Jeremy.
We're still in the 300s in the US market. So we got quite a ways to go, but you know, no
yeah,
day
but
like
there's
today.
Way more in the US. So maybe it's like 300 of like 3 billion.
And do you know your rankings at all? Is that something you look at?
Not anymore, but I know we were ranked number one in the food category.
But
showing up, us there, up. Like above like Nigella.
Oh my
I took
God.
A screenshot of it. So it actually happened. That was back when we did it weekly. But
whoa.
Yeah.
Podcast royalty.
I'm excited. Should we get into it?
We should. Laura, get us started with your link of the week.
Yes. Okay. So this is a big piece. We've got a few big pieces today, actually. Jeremy, this is one that you found and posted to our professional development Slack channel, and it comes from the New York Times, written by Clarissa Sebag Montefiore, I think. Great name. And it's titled, Is the Way Australia Funds the Arts a Recipe for Mediocrity? And so it came out early September, just a few weeks ago, and it's a fairly lengthy article looking at the state of arts funding in Australia or lack thereof, with a particular focus on the performing arts. And the thrust of it is that a growing number of artistic leaders across the country have come to believe that government funding for all the performing arts is simply sort of not enough, or nor is it as well spent as it could be or should be, perhaps. So early on in the piece, she states that in 2017, Australia had the second highest wealth per adult in the world, which is around 402,600, just behind Switzerland. And in general, the Australian economy has been growing uninterrupted for the last 26 years, and population growth has soared as well. But arts funding hasn't really kept up with this pace, and it's only risen by 8% since 2011. And I think given the sort of clearly stated positions of the current ScoMo government, I don't think we can expect much growth in that area in the near future. And what's worse, she argues, is that the funding that does exist is run in the same way that it has been for years, and it hasn't adapted to fit the changing landscape of the industry. For example, the article points out that the vast majority of funding for the performing arts comes from the federal government through an agency called the Australia Council. And so for some of those grants, the decisions are based on assessments by panels of artists, art workers, and industry experts. But more than half of that funding goes to this group of 28 large organizations that aren't subject to these peer assessments of their sort of effectiveness. So they refer to these 28 organizations as the majors, and it includes various theaters, orchestras, ballets, operas, various companies in that area that have relied on government money for many years. And the issue, as some people see it, is that smaller groups are being cut out of this funding, and that the funding isn't truly based on merit, but rather on sort of outdated ideas about what makes certain art forms more worthy than others. The article sort of hints at a tendency to revere more traditional art forms and repertoires, the ones that sort of value the arts cultures of Europe and North America over Australia's own, which is you know, of course, a lot younger. And some are arguing, both in the article and in the comments section, that these majors are routinely underperforming and staging sort of artistically stagnant productions, despite or perhaps precisely because of their privileged standing. Yaron Lifshitz, the artistic director of Circa, who was interviewed for this piece as well, they believe that in doing this, the government is entrenching a culture in the Australian performing arts of overfunding mediocrity, as they put it. And that's obviously where the title of this piece comes from. And they complain of seeing many truly talented young artists not having the resources to create and perform work to their full capacity, and that many of the majors are playing heritage works to aging audiences rather than sort of assisting in creating a thriving future for the Australian performing arts industry. And then, you know, you can contrast this with a particularly scathing comment from a reader that starts like this: oof, get over it. You're a victim. You deserve the privilege to have what is yours by right. Because of your great and anointed genius, the money has to come to you. And if it doesn't, the world is unjust and racist, and you're a victim of corporate greed because you are too good to be bothered to do work or waste your time on labor rather than the great thought for which you may be the vessel through which inspired creativity passes. Oh, such glory, such brightness, I am not worthy. So there's a bit of sarcasm in there.
And I want to fund that guy's next book of poems.
I know. I mean, we always play sort of comment of the, you know, pick of the comments whenever we do a piece like this. I think that's probably got to be mine. But yes, you do start to see some of the range in views on this touchy subject. There was another person interviewed for the piece, Joe Corst, who is an associate professor at the University of Melbourne, where they research art funding. And they felt that the way the funding works comes down to these, again, entrenched ideas about what's artistically valuable and how that's often at odds with more popular art forms. So funding is seen as sort of rewarding elite artistic practices. And she made the point that even though there are sort of big questions that need to be asked, the problem is that changing the pattern of funding is extremely difficult because, you know, partly because of the many powerful forces that would fight any change like this to the death. And then, you know, conversely, you've got Patrick Nolan, who's the artistic director of Opera Queensland, who I can assume is probably one of those powerful forces that would fight any of these changes to the death. He takes issue with the whole sort of us and them viewpoint, saying, you know, that they as a large organization collaborate with many other small and medium-sized performing arts companies, and that dismantling the majors would have a really detrimental effect on the entire ecosystem of the arts, pointing, you know, out that for each production, Opera Queensland hires up to 200 artists and crew members from outside of their own sort of things. So anyway, there's a lot more to this piece, but already this raises just a lot of questions for me. And I think there's a lot to unpack on all sides of this. There's sort of the fundamental question of what companies, both within the arts and outside of it, which of these companies deserve government funding and why, versus sort of having to raise their own capital like, you know, we do. And is this something that should be reserved for nonprofits? And then even then, how do we decide that any particular nonprofit deserves a certain amount of funding or not? And there's that sort of longstanding question as well of how we value artistic pursuits as a society, you know, this sort of struggling artist kind of type view, and how do we sort of expect artists to live like that? How we value the contributions of those artists and whether we believe that supporting those pursuits is beneficial to society as a whole and not just to the artists themselves. And then there's also this sort of consistent issue of a lack of engagement with the arts by huge portions of society. Not to say that they should have to, but what are people in arts institutions doing to engage broader sections of the community and potentially increase their funding in that way? And is it possible to do that without compromising on the creative quality of the work? So look, Jeremy, I want to start with you. You've been involved in various art exploits of both commercial and non-commercial natures. How did you feel about all of this? Do you think that arts groups deserve government funding?
Absolutely. I mean, like everything else, I'm kind of divided in on things. And I also kind of think, yeah, there's the whole kind of cultural aspect as well, the difference between the American model and the Australian model. I thought it was interesting that was brought up, and even that this was kind of brought up in the Times. I think, is this the first kind of Australian focused piece from the Times that we've discussed here?
Actually, I think it might be the second. I remember doing one other a while ago.
Just to fill people in, like, Australia is pretty much where the New York Times is kind of now set up this kind of very significant kind of presence. And so it's really kind of interesting as well to kind of know the provenance of the articles as well, and kind of who's writing them, because I don't know, I've always associated the New York Times with a very kind of American, especially kind of liberal New York kind of perspective, which I admire and very much attuned with. And so it's so interesting to see how they've kind of brought that into Australia and how, you know, these issues that have kind of always been here in Australia in a way are kind of being raised now by, I guess, you know, foreign journalists in a way. So in terms of, I guess, my personal opinion, it's funny because I always say when I'm kind of talking about Jackie Winter and kind of where we came from like that, there's, because there's such kind of support for the arts, that's from the government specifically, that people can, there are so many kind of more opportunities for people to kind of evolve their practice. And just, we were talking before about European artists, and especially like when there's a lot of kind of government support, like when you can, when you know that you can kind of eat and get all your basic needs met, that tends to foster more kind of creative environments, or at least different ones. But at the same time, like then the other part of me who has kind of tried to kind of interface with kind of these grants and these huge behemoth organizations, I find them so disincentivizing the actual pathway to get the funds. There's so many kind of strings attached to it, and they're really kind of not set up to kind of service kind of smaller individual artists. And then I kind of have seen when I've kind of done work for kind of festivals like for Next Wave and things like that, how their funding is very, you know, tied into these kind of bigger models as well. And yeah, there's a lot of kind of hoops to kind of jump through. So I don't know, like I personally think it's a mix of kind of both is kind of good, but yeah.
Do you have any feelings about how the decision should be made about like who gets funding and why? Because there's a finite amount of funds, obviously, inevitably.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, with when you're kind of funding something like Next Wave, then it is kind of, you get this idea that it's kind of trickling down, you know, to kind of artists like in that way. So I think if those kind of more, I guess the thrust of this as well is kind of is a bit, I don't know if it's ageist, but they're making a statement of the quality of the work when really what they're saying is, well, these things are kind of old. Like, I don't know if it's kind of mediocre just because they're kind of bigger organizations.
I'm not sure. And I don't think it goes necessarily enough into it. I have heard outside of this piece, though, complaints of, I guess, the lack of originality and the lack of, I mean, like if we're pouring money into these things, it's like you, rather than just rehashing performances from other parts of the world, like would it not be better to put the money into organizations in Australia that are contributing to new Australian works? I don't know. And what do you think about all this stuff?
Are you guys part of the New York Times Australia Facebook group?
Is there a group? I get yeah. The what's that?
It's just a little like they post articles and people like have conversations about it. The author of this piece posted the article alongside a quote that was left out of the article by Yaron Lifshitz and from Circa. And they said, there is a culture in some companies of entitlement and complacency, which I think is deeply unhelpful to creating great art. So I think like I can kind of see both ways, like when you're funded by the government, that could create complacency because there's no real incentive to create new work. And the other side of the coin is like guaranteed funding allows you to like forward plan so and create like a real culture around what you're doing and like hire people and like sustain
absolutely.
It. So like I'm torn, like I'm not really sure what the solution is.
Absolutely. But. And it's like such a multifaceted issue. I think like it would be very easy to speak to, you know, certain people and get one very clear sort of view on the issue and speak to another. So I do like that in this piece, they did speak to a range of people who were sort of treating this and viewing this differently. And then there were also people who deliberately had gone sort of alternative routes to the sort of funding route because particularly, what's the puppet? What was the
Dead Puppet Society?
Dead Puppet Society. That's it. So they, I mean, they do sort of one-off grants, but they don't apply for any of the sort of longer-term funding because of the sort of the issues with how, I guess, the bureaucracy involved, and that they find that they are allowed more creative control. You talked about how there's so many strings attached, and that's both sort of, I guess, financially, but also in like what you're allowed to do with that money. And if they raise their own capital, they can, whether it's through private donations or through ticket sales or whatever, that they have retained so much creative control. It reminded me of, like when we're talking way back about self-publishing versus like working with a traditional sort of publisher method and how like, I guess the difference in having that like backing of funding, but you hand over the reins or, you know, you limit what you're able to do. Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely there were some similarities there.
Yeah, look, I think government, as soon as you get government and the arts kind of intersecting, there's always going to be some kind of tension. And I've always talked a lot about, I don't know if I've actually mentioned here, but like, you know, the whole way that governments try to take the tendering process and when they're commissioning public art, for example, or kind of working for councils, and they try to take the tendering process, which is meant for kind of construction and kind of capital-based projects and apply that to creativity, you don't get very kind of creative things, basically. So I think that it's really hard to kind of generalize this article because they're really only focusing on kind of drama as well. They don't really give kind of a full picture of, I guess, the entire the spectrum of kind of arts publishing, but I mean, sorry, of arts funding. I want to kind of say that the more you need kind of creative people there who are actually kind of giving out the money, and the more you can get it kind of in the hands of directly kind of to artists, probably the better of the result you're going to get. I think taking those huge amounts of funds and like, if you gave those to specific artists and in kind of smaller amounts, you could reach a whole lot more people. So I think there are probably more riskier moves that could kind of be taken that I don't kind of see taken.
Yeah, because it's the government and the government don't tend to take.
Exactly. That's the whole thing.
Really
it's like
hard, yeah.
when you bring in that funding model, like I think art is inherently kind of risky, and the way that government spends money, people don't want their tax dollars kind of risked on something.
Yeah,
you know?
which I understand as well. I mean, even though I am within the arts and I completely support arts funding, I mean, 100%. Of course I do, given the work that I do. Something else I wanted to bring up with you guys that they mentioned in the piece was they talk about the sort of distinctly Australian issue with cultural cringe. Mm. You know, is this something that you guys have experienced yourself? I mean, Jeremy, obviously you're not originally from here, but you've been here a long time, and you're a Melbourne gal?
Yeah.
You're a Melbourne gal. Yeah. I mean, how do you feel about Australian arts, in particular things like sort of theatre, film, performance? Is there anything in these sort of criticisms that the art scene in Australia is not as good as other places?
I think we're definitely as good, but it's kind of like, I think the article made the comparison to sport, and I think no one would deny that Australia punches above its weight in the sporting field. Mm. But I don't think the same could be said for art. Like, well, I haven't heard that.
And perhaps I think specific practitioners, but not as a whole.
Yeah. I think that probably comes down to like funding, but also comes down to the emphasis placed on sport as opposed to art in school, like from when you're tiny. Like, I remember doing so much sport at school, and really I can remember the teachers that really pushed me to do art, and it was really only one teacher in primary school and a handful in high school.
Mm. Really? Because I would say from like from an American perspective that Australian actors and actresses especially like have a huge elevated perception like kind of in America and Hollywood.
Yeah, that's true.
But there's like four.
No.
Actually, Kate Blanchett, when she was on Stephen Colbert's show, she said that Australia, I've got the quote here, "In Australia, we have wonderful, wonderful cultural industries, but often success is not rewarded. But the wonderful thing in this country, in America, is that success is rewarded." Mm. And I think that is kind of true. It's like that tall poppy syndrome thing. Like, I think we're really like trying to rise above it, but as soon as someone's successful in the art, they're really not treated in the same way as if they've won a gold medal.
I completely agree. And I think as well, there's also very much a, like, to be successful in the arts, you get to a point and then the goal is to leave Australia for so many people, you know. Yeah. It's not to actually, precisely because it isn't rewarded in that way, and there's not as much of a market. And I mean, the size of our market plays a lot into it as well. Mm. Like, we don't have the kind of population that can support all those niche sort of explorations. But
well, it's great that for the New York Times are giving, I guess, a new voice kind of to these kind of issues. We'll post a link to the Australian Facebook group. And also, there's an amazing letter they do every week called the Australian Dispatch, which kind of gives a bit of a summary of all the journalism that they're doing here. And also, as part of that, yeah, one of our artists, Ilya Milstein, had also done an amazing piece of Australians kind of in New York as well. We'll put the link to all of those, as we do every week, in our show notes and move on from there. Our second link for the week comes from yours truly, and this is something I am just so excited to talk about. These are five links. There's a story told in five articles on the marketing and advertising kind of industry site called Mumbrella, who typically don't publish great stuff, I must say. Like, you know, I just think there's really no room for kind of, I haven't seen much good journalism done in many of these sites. I mean, definitely Mumbrella does some, but this was kind of hard-hitting reporting on a court case that was pretty much going on between a client, which was a kind of pharmaceutical company or kind of, well, beauty, this is a tough word, a company who made kind of a hair product, versus their ad agency, Icon, here in Melbourne, and basically them kind of suing their agency because of low performance of a campaign. And the trial went over 8 days. The incident in question is from 2015. So it really gives you an idea for how long kind of this process has been going on for it to actually kind of be seen in court. And it's kind of so rare for this kind of stuff to happen, but it's amazing. So to get to the gist of it, The company, Advangen, they manufacture hair treatment products, blames the agency for a failed campaign that had a paltry impact on sales and included a TV ad that claims completely missed its target audience. And amongst all this as well, they kind of are also accusing Icon of potentially misleading them for a billing error as well. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's kind of come out through this. And Mumbrella actually kind of ran five different articles here going through the beginning of the case to the end and all the witnesses that were called and the kind of the things that were kind of discussed. But it was, there's so many kind of amazing nuggets in here, including the name of the agency that Advangen hired after Icon to fix things. And the name of the agency was called Chaos.
Yeah.
That was a fantastic bit.
Oh, great sign.
But yeah, they kind of, you know, talked about how like all this kind of basically it all kind of came after the fact, basically. So the client was on board with all the kind of creative. The creative was kind of launched. And then the shareholders kind of started putting pressure on the managing director, who put pressure on the marketing agency. And then they pretty much disputed the bill and effectively then didn't pay it. And then
Icon countersued. Basically.
Then Icon kind of countersued, basically. And so, yeah, that's kind of where this kind of whole thing emerged. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, despite all the circumstances that happened, I'm really surprised that this is the first time a case like this has actually kind of gone on to trial. And you can assume that both parties spent an enormous amount of money on it. Laura, what were your initial reactions? Like, my mouth was open the whole time reading it.
Those lawyers are making bank. That's all I could think about over and over. I was like, fuck, no one wins in this except the lawyers. But anyway, it is worth pointing out that at the time of this recording, the 9-day court battle has finally wrapped up, but the judge is still yet to hand down a verdict. So by the time this episode is released, there might be further word. Who knows, we might need to add a little update if that happens. Yeah, Jeremy, I mean, there's a lot to unravel here. There's the sort of technical legal side of things in terms of who is contractually obliged to do what. And then there's the sort of broader conversation around what the responsibilities and processes should be on both the agency and client sides to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen. So I think, look, we'll tackle the legal technicalities.
But that's the thing. It seemed like everything that was kind of met. It's like, you know, looking through, and again, like we don't know everything. And we don't know kind of the full story here. We can just kind of go by what was reported.
Yeah. I mean, we're not privy to the exact details of the business agreement, nor do we have sort of full clarity on the process through which they actually sort of developed the campaign and produced it and took it to market. But I think we can safely assume from our knowledge and experience of the industry that no campaign goes to market without at least several rounds of feedback and approval from the client. And also that no agency can promise exact sales results.
Well, that's a huge point as well that I found is really interesting, because like so many different agencies are trying to kind of come up with different kind of models like to bill clients and like how they're defining kind of what success is. But I just think as a foundation, there's no way to kind of guarantee results for anything. Like,
no,
not even advertising.
And they shouldn't be. And it sounds like they didn't. I mean, from the snippets of the court proceedings that have been made public, it seems that there indeed was a basic process of briefings, presentations of ideas, approvals from client. And so on that alone, you know, the fact that they, you know, the fact that the client didn't contest anything during the process and in fact gave it sort of pretty clear approval, you know, that they were in favor of the campaign creative. I think you do sort of legally have to side with the agency here, you know, at least in terms of a legal ruling. Now, I mean, that said, that doesn't actually mean that Icon necessarily upheld the best duty of care or did everything that they should have to, you know, to produce what the client was after. And that definitely raises larger questions around what the duty of care really is and what sort of efforts and precautions are being taken during the development of a campaign to maximize its effectiveness. And I think that's a lot of the conversation that I think the industry is having sort of now as a result of this. It's not the actual legal outcome. It's more like, I mean, it is, because that will set a big precedent for future cases. But I guess that's sort of the argument that clients and agencies is kind of having with each other now. But yeah, I think that's besides the point in the particular legal case. Like, the client approved it without issue. Personally, I don't believe that they have legal
recourse.
And it's
in the Supreme Court. So basically whatever happens here is going to set precedent.
Exactly.
But the most dangerous thing, I think, and the reason that I feel this is so relevant, is because we're talking about, like, everything here is kind of really subjective. And like, it's amazing how they bring these kind of people on as kind of expert witnesses.
Oh, God,
One quote I want to kind of bring is like, turning to the TV ad, he reiterated that it contained pretty pictures and nice hair, but didn't portray the real nature of the product. It therefore fell short of the standard. And so it's like, well, yeah, how do you kind of, when you read everything, the narrative that I think emerges is that someone wanted some advertising. They went to an ad agency, they got exactly what they said they were given, but then it you know, whatever, sales didn't eventuate and someone's kind of backpedaling and trying to kind of reverse
engineer. They also let it run for 6 weeks before they canceled it. Like, it's crazy. They did not give it a chance, like, whatsoever. But yeah, the client are arguing, like, you know, the fact that they liked and approved the creative is irrelevant because the lawyer said, because the client know nothing about creating a successful campaign, that's why they hired Icon. So the onus should be on Icon to deliver an effective ad and reach sales targets. And the fact that they allegedly didn't constitutes a breach of contract. And that's sort of the crux of their argument. And I mean, look, of course, all sorts of questions have been raised during the proceedings around what was actually promised to the client in an attempt to figure out whether there actually has been a breach or anything. But I mean, that's kind of an insane defense, don't you think?
It's so scary. And it's like, you know, and it's happened here as well, where, like, you know, someone wants to kind of cancel a job. And then it's like, you know, when that happens, like, how do you decide, like, oh, well, were kind of terms breached and all these kind of other things? I mean, it's crazy. And
at the same time, if you hire an expert to do something and they're not capable of what they said they were, like, if I hired, I mean, this is a pretty extreme example, but if I go to a doctor and they give me bad medical advice, like, I expect them. Bad medicine.
Oh, fuck. I'm just trying to make a Bon Jovi joke. Anyway.
Way too young for that reference, Jeremy.
So close.
You talk to my dad, he'll get it. But yeah, I mean, like, I'm not going to, I mean, I expect a certain level of expertise and authority that I don't have. And even if I agree with them, that yes, I'll take this medication.
And did you look at the material and the ads in question?
Yeah, yeah.
What did you think? I mean, you've been on the creative side as well.
You do content.
Like, do you think it was effective?
I don't think it was an effective ad, but I don't think it should have gotten to the time where they were actually filming the ad. Like, the client and agencies need to work together in a partnership for any kind of ad to be effective at all. And this just reeks of somebody not owning their decision to hire Icon and kind of like being involved in what they're creating. You can't just hire an agency and let them do whatever they want, because I think big agencies would kind of be shitting themselves over this. Like,
oh yeah,
the duty of care thing. Agencies have so many different priorities, not just the client's objectives. It's like, is this going to win us awards? Is this going to look good? Is this going to make us win agency?
Will we have profit margins on this?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think agencies will be really looking at this closely and kind of examining how they respond to client briefs.
Completely. Because I mean, that whole question of like, can you hold an agency liable for the work they produce, is it's a massive one. And then also, like, if so, like, how would you define and sort of measure that? And also, like, what kind of effect would that have on the creative work that people are willing to produce? Like, for example, you can kind of look at the US sometimes and see certain clear examples of how a culture of litigation can sort of affect output, you know, and to see that happening in this kind of space is scary.
And that's the whole interesting thing. It's like that advertising and kind of storytelling is a very kind of emotive art that is very kind of subjective, and you're getting people to kind of change their behavior, with which there's no kind of, you know, set way to kind of do. Like, you know, you're influencing people to do something. It's hard to kind of put like an objective kind of framework around that.
I don't know that you can set parameters around something like this in a legal context, you know, without doing something that's quite damaging to the industry and to the relationships of everyone involved, I think. But it is so tricky, because at the same time, you've got agencies selling themselves in based on being capable of producing the best possible creative that achieves real results. And so perhaps there is something in the idea that they should be held accountable somehow if what they produce doesn't warrant the millions of dollars that you as a client are spending on them. But then again, yeah, how do you attribute the success or lack of success to a campaign alone? You're like, there's so many other factors that, you know, in the environment that affect the success or not success of something. And I mean, yeah, and as well, as we keep saying, in this particular instance especially, the client should probably accept some responsibility for their sort of inherent role in the process. You know, the creative team can only really work with what they're given.
It takes a lot of nerve to contest a bill that kind of big as well. And it's like, and when you're making a TVC, like, so many kind of steps have to happen. Like, it seems crazy that someone would
think about all the people
something.
Who haven't been paid because of this, like the crew and stuff on set. And then these people.
Exactly.
And
I'd be really curious to know about that, because would the production company would have been contracted to Gray, not to their client? How many times have we been, you know, a client is late on paying invoice and there's like, oh, well, our client hasn't paid us. Like, how far is the kind of buck kind of keep getting passed
around? Those people still need to get paid. I think just as always, we have to look at the comments section, because that's especially with an umbrella article.
And there were many.
I mean, you know, Mumbrella being an ad industry publication frequented, I'd say, only by people who work in or adjacent to ad agencies, because, I mean, why the fuck else would you read this stuff? The comments do swing mostly in favor of Icon, the agency. But for example, there was one that said, you know, if I engage an architect, approve their designs, have the place built, improve or take delivery, but then my friends don't like it, can I sue? Which I kind of
But
like.
That's effectively what they're doing, though.
Exactly. And then another one said, you know, typical, this was of the, what's her name, Halas, the woman who was on the stand, the representative from Advangen, who took the stand during the court trial. This comment references her. It says, typical chief exec glossing over the details, then trying to pass the buck, it sounds like. This should be instantly dismissed, and Advangen sound like they need more competency at the top. So there was a lot of stuff. There was another one that thought exactly how I thought, you know, of the lawyers being the only ones who win from this sort of sorry saga, which, oh, fuck, they would have made so much money off this. But yeah, I mean, it's my, oh, that's it. My personal favorite. I forgot about this one. This comes from someone who called themselves Dat Earned Media, who said, Icon should be billing them for their guerrilla campaign, reaching all the balding ad execs reading this, which I thought was
That's actually
brilliant.
Very true. I mean, yeah, I never heard of the product before, but I sure have now.
Yeah.
You know, I think one thing, you know, obviously reach is so much harder to quantify in when you're talking about kind of TV or kind of, you know, more traditionally placed media. And that's where kind of programmatic online advertising is, you know, getting around these issues. Mm. Like you can prove to a client, like, you know, how many kind of impressions were made if someone's actually clicking and engaging with something.
But I think there are other types of engagement that are valuable, even if they're harder to measure. Like, so it's a shame if we're seeing things only go towards that.
Oh, totally valuable. And I'm just kind of curious, like, how this kind of works, like, or, you know, with you on the creative side and, you know, kind of generating content for people to engage with and advertise in this way has, you know, not to talk about kind of specific scenarios or anything like that, but like, is this something that you kind of think about, like, as a creative and as you're kind of developing a brief? Like, how do you fit this into your practice?
Yeah, I always start with the client objective and make sure that whatever idea I'm thinking of actually answers that. And a lot of the time, we're doing brand work, so you can't actually prove that it's successful. And a lot of the time at Broadsheet, our little stream is in addition to the TV ad, the radio ad. So it's very hard to work out exactly which part of the success was attributed to us. But at the same time, I think a really interesting part of that article was when, I can't remember the people's names, but basically they said, when I was shown the ad, the agency was applauding and there was lots of celebration. So I didn't feel like I could say anything. I find that so terrifying. So, like, you should always feel like you should say something as a client. Like, if you're not happy with the ad, you're the one paying for it. So you need to make sure you're happy with it.
But again, like, something so deeply wrong with the structure of the relationship that they weren't able, like.
But if you don't like it at that stage, like, think of how much, like, you know, even when we're doing kind of animations and everything from the script to the storyboard to the board-o-matic to the animatic to the, you know, to the keyframes and everything. It's like, there's so much chance. I think that's just what's really disturbing about me is that it even got to kind of court, you know, in that way, because, like, yeah, like, you know, you can just kind of change your mind about something. And does that mean that someone's kind of legally at fault or something?
No. And I think, of course, like, I think Icon can be held accountable in the sense of, like, losing the account or future work if the client weren't happy with the output. Like, that's, of course, that's something they could do. But, you know, definitely not to have the initially agreed costs withheld and not to be held accountable in court. That's pretty bloody outrageous, I think. The other thing I just wanted to mention, you touched before, Jeremy, on the four experts that they interviewed in court, which I think was the industry authorities, they said that they questioned in the Sydney Supreme Court about the merits of the TV ads, including Jane Carrow, who I only know from her appearances on Gruen Transfer.
Oh, she's all over Twitter. She's really great on Twitter.
Oh, got to check her out. But she was surprisingly very strongly in favor of the idea that the agency, that Icon, didn't do their jobs properly and that the ads they created weren't satisfactory, which is kind of an interesting position to take given what this sort of ruling could mean for the ad industry as a whole. But then on the flip side, owner of Gap Research, John Grotto, called the ads powerful, which I think is just fucking hilarious if you've seen the ads. Like, I mean, whether or not they're good or bad, like, they're powerful. It's barely any ad is powerful. I mean, and then the lawyer for the agency side even described, he said that the agency's use of the word formula in the voiceover was creative brilliance. Like, what?
Wow.
I know. Arguably hilarious again.
Look, I mean, jokes aside, like, I think everyone should be paying kind of attention to the outcome of this, because even if you're kind of like, the fact that this kind of got to court tells me that this is kind of something that much kind of smaller businesses and freelancers like will and can be kind of facing, and could be potentially devastating for your business or finances, like if this opens up the potential for further litigation there. So look, all we're going to link to all kind of five pieces. Hopefully there'll be a sixth one that kind of comes out that gives the summary in a few weeks' time. Really interesting piece of journalism, and I applaud Mumbrella for, you know, going into it. And if the full transcripts or the full kind of legal case is kind of open, I'd be really into kind of digging into it a bit deeper. But
next book club.
Until then, we'll leave it there. Thanks, guys. Moving on to our last link of the week, which Emily brings us. It's not so much a article as almost like an entire book in itself.
Sorry about that, guys.
But I thought it was really very relevant, especially kind of on the topic of trust, especially, I think, because that's kind of what was eroded before with Icon and their agency. So I think that just goes to show how important kind of trust is. But Em, I'm really curious to hear more about this kind of piece. Where did you find it? It's from a few years ago, but it's something that you've come back to recently?
Yeah. So it's from 2011, which is basically prehistoric in the internet years. But yeah, it's really relevant. I found it when I was doing a mindful leadership course last year, and it's something that I keep coming back to. It's on the European Business Review, and it's called Leadership and the Structure of Trust. And basically, it's all about how trust is really important for a relationship or a team to function properly. And I think this is about the business setting, but it's all really relevant to the creative industries as well. It kind of goes into basically how there are four drivers of trust if you want to have a better relationship with your team or your freelancers, that kind of thing. And all four drivers of trust are really essential to survival through evolution. So they kind of like hark back to then. So there's the drive to acquire, the drive to bond, the drive to create, and the drive to defend. And the drive to create and bond create trust in a team, and the drive to acquire and defend are really important as well, but placing too much emphasis on them weakens trust. So basically the drive to acquire is about competing to get essential resources or to control your environment. The drive to defend is to protect yourself from threats and have security and safety. The drive to bond is to form long-term relationships and cooperate and build teams. And the drive to create is to like learn, imagine, and invent. So for me personally, like the drive to create is something that's really innate in me. But I think I also have a really strong drive to acquire, which I need to like rein in sometimes. And I really need to, over the past year after doing that course, I've really worked on my drive to bond, which I think has enabled our team to work a lot better and me to be a better leader and kind of got a lot more value out of the team, and people are achieving their goals, and it's really great. So I just wanted to ask you guys, is there a personal drive that's kind of strongest in you? And have you noticed that?
It's so funny because I find it really hard to kind of interface with these kind of different archetypes in this kind of way, or like, you know, even though they're kind of bringing out kind of certain things. I talk about Tim Ferriss all the time. I don't know
why. Obsessed with Tim Ferriss.
I don't even like him that much.
He sucks.
But he brought up this other thing called engrams. You know about them? Mm-hmm. Like these kind of tests that you do to kind of figure out, like, okay, what kind of person are you and kind of what do you need and all those kind of things. And I don't know, it feels to me like a lot like horoscopes in kind of some ways. You know, it's like obviously you can read into kind of any of these kind of drivers and kind of find yourself kind of somewhere. I think the thing that I was interested most in this article was this whole idea about it, like whether trust can kind of be designed. And I kind of thought like, well, this is interesting, but like, doesn't this have the potential, like if trust can be designed, doesn't that have the potential for people who are inherently untrustworthy or running businesses that rely on deception that they can then manufacture the kind of qualities of trust and to
kind of... kind of talk about a little bit about how being trusting can be dangerous when they go into a whole bit about psychopaths, which I was kind of like, I'm into this. That was like, I really liked this article. I did as well. I found it a little hard to read in some ways. Sometimes there were certain bits that I was like, I had to reread the article, like the paragraph a few times. And they would say sometimes phrases that I was like, what? At one point they said something about innovating synergistically. And I was like, I don't understand. And then there was also a line about, it was like people who had normal childhoods remember the time when the world felt safe.
And I was
like,
that was really
where did that come from? That's such a bizarre thing. But
I thought, sorry, just to go back. I mean, that was the most the really interesting point. Like, considering this was written kind of 2011, and I think, you know, trust is such a huge, big deal now, like with everyone's trust eroding kind of in mainstream media and kind of news especially. And they kind of say, if we don't bring trust to the forefront, the normal chaos of business becomes even more tumultuous as we spin erratically and unpredictably into a world of distrust. And I kind of think, well, and they were saying how the distrust comes from kind of fear. And I think, yeah, the more kind of, especially you look at governments, they kind of stoke fear, the more that kind of distrust kind of ripples throughout. And it's definitely, I guess, a bit of an epidemic at the moment.
I think with going back to specifically the four drivers that you mentioned, the drive to acquire, to bond, to create, and to defend, when I first started reading about them, I was like, because I always, as well, like Jeremy, I get a bit like kind of skeptical with this stuff, because I just think I've read so many books where like each person has found their own way to divide people into like a, you know, and I was like, well, how do they know this? And then I checked the annotation and it was like some guy's self-help book or whatever. But saying that, I actually really do think this is a good way to sort of divide the drives. I think this covers the basis, like that would be inherent in different levels in all people. Obviously, the point is, and they go through this, that like my drive to bond might be different to your drive to bond, you know, but these four things kind of make up the essential motivating forces of us as humans. And I think that's quite true, actually, even though I have no real like proof for it. But I think personally, like you mentioned, acquire and create was sort of yours. I think acquire and bond are probably where I fit the strongest. I definitely feel the most alignment with those two. But I do, and I definitely think, although it might be a kind of, maybe it's an arbitrary way of dividing people, I think some of the advice that they give in terms of how to nurture an environment of trust and nurture people's drives in this way is positive. And I think it logically stands to reason that you would want to nurture the sort of bonding and creating elements more than you want to nurture defense and acquisition.
How have you done it, Em? Like, are there kind of concrete things that you did kind of through learning about this that you implemented? Because the whole idea here is that if there's trust in your team, everything just kind of flows easier, basically.
First of all, now you've got me thinking like I've drunk the Kool-Aid. And I'm kind of starting to second guess myself, but I think it actually has helped.
We have that effect on everyone, don't worry.
Broadsheet is so fast paced. Like we've got a really small team and work, like we had six people for most of last year and work on 60 clients at once. So it's actually crazy. And there's often not time to reflect or stop or even think about what you're doing. And so kind of having to force yourself to have times when you look at work outside of Broadsheet and think, look at what other people are doing in this space. So like we have at the start of our WIP now, we have a thing called I Wish I Thought of That, where every week someone brings in something that they wish they thought of that's completely different to what we do, to kind of inspire creativity and also get people get to share their interests and kind of share a different side to themselves that they normally get to do. Or like we also do this thing called a spot of fishing where it's about coming up with proactive ideas, the ideas that we really want to work on that we think would make us really happy in our jobs, and kind of retrofitting a client to that. So we end up working on the things we really want to do. So yeah, after reading this, I kind of started to put more of those kind of meetings into our weekly format. And I think it's kind of helped the team bond and helped us create better work as well.
I mean, I can see explicitly how that, those things would happen. That's really cool. I like that a lot.
I mean, yeah, you can go to very kind of cliche ideas of kind of team building, and the whole idea of the trust fall is something that's always kind of parodied, you know, in kind
I'd
of
drop
you. Yeah. Thank you. I would trust you to drop me. But a lot of this is about kind of, you know, I think also when I guess client and creatives kind of come together, sometimes I've kind of seen that you get that initial kind of moment where nobody trusts each other, where it's like the creative thinks that the client's trying to undercut them. The client thinks that the creative's trying to kind of put one over them. And you know, that thing where you just immediately get off to the kind of the wrong foot with people. And I think for us, that's kind of something that we're always kind of trying to do is improve kind of these relationships. Laura, I've seen you work this, your magic with many kind of clients. What about like, you know, turning relationships around and kind of getting them to trust kind of us? How do you think we do that? Or do you do that personally?
Oh, I mean, it's a mix of things and it's going to be different for each client. I think it's that same thing that we often talk about is that like, I don't think there's a one size fits all solution. It's really about whoever the person or the organization as a whole will have a sort of personality, but the person specifically that you're dealing with will have a way that they like to do things and a way that they like to deliver information and receive information. And if you can tune into that and complement that, and I don't mean, it's not just like mimicking in like in a manipulative way, it's in a considerate way for how they like to communicate. Usually that definitely, I find that really helps to build trust in that they can see that you're making an effort to engage with them on their level, on their wavelength, and that can really, really help. And again, another thing, I mean, this is such basic stuff, but it's like you have to be reminded of it is that like just like actively listening for people's pain points and their issues and then making it clear that you're there to address that, not to make that harder, and everyone's soft spots will be different, and their areas of caution or distrust will be different as well. And so sort of approaching those gently or aggressively if that person is someone who appreciates that kind of communication as well. I think so much of the trust that we have between our clients comes from educating a client on like why they can trust us with certain types of projects, or to quote things fairly, or you know, for a particular artist to do a particular job well. It's a lot of it is about knowing how to communicate our services to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of it, laying kind of that foundation. And that's kind of why I also have such a thing with kind of terms and conditions, because like once you get into terms and conditions, the trust has kind of already been broken. So that's kind of a bit of a safety net there, like the whole legal option. But you have to wonder, like if the trust was really built in that Icon case, like how would it have been different?
Totally. I sometimes think about projects where something has broken down, and like with one client, when that breaks down, things are like people are arguing over excess costs, or they're the projects that have come to a halt. You kind of are at loggerheads with each other. With another client, another project, the exact same problem could happen, but the way you will respond to it would be so different just because of that relationship that you have with each other. Like instead of blaming and trying to figure out who has to figure out the mess, there's this sort of team effort of like, oh, firstly, there's like apologies on both sides, and you're both trying to fix it together and work as a team. And it's like interesting how the same problems can generate such different reactions depending on that level of trust. And even just like within the workplace, like we've talked on the podcast before as well about how in order to not just with clients, but with your coworkers, like a level of trust is so important in order to be able to work together, both like because you trust begets respect, and respecting someone's work, I think, is really, really important if you're going to work on a team together. But also, trusting them in the sense that you feel safe to voice your opinions and do your best work and let your thoughts out.
I think one last thing I just want to touch on in the creative industry, one thing that I find can be really challenging is that a lot of creatives sometimes feel that advertising and media is a deceptive medium, that they're getting people to kind of do things that they might not have wanted to do, or they're giving voice to kind of a product or service that they might not believe in, so that they feel kind of they're a mouthpiece, they're kind of deceiving people, they're lying to people. And have you ever kind of come across these kind of emotions, and how do you reconcile with that?
All the time. There's like millions of brands out there, and they're not all going to align with whoever you're working for or you personally. And yeah, sometimes you have to. It's so dodgy.
But sometimes it becomes about like, okay, if these people are going to sort of advertise, you know, regardless. And if I can at least try and do that in a way that looks beautiful,
exactly,
in a way that is less dodgy, that I don't know, there's some merit in that, isn't there?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's about being truthful about those things kind of within the team and kind of talking about them. Like I think.
And also having limits, right? Like there's a point you can flex that until eventually you would flat out not work with them. Like I'm sure there are certain clients that we haven't really been in that position much, really, but there are certain clients that we would absolutely not create work for because of who the client is. And I've had artists of ours turn down work purely because they don't want to work with, I don't know, a cigarette company or an electricity company or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, I think that's something kind of that every kind of creative is reckoning with more. And I think that's why there has been a huge kind of boon in social enterprise. And that's because that's where people want to go. They want to have that meaning in their work. But at the same time, I feel there can be some kind of separation where you can kind of consider the work you do in terms of communicating for brands, like as a craft and as an art form, and
how
interact kind of with other people as well. The kind of the qualities of truth that you and honesty and compassion that you can provide in kind of a interaction, even if the whole interaction doesn't need to be this kind of pure thing. But yeah, there are aspects there that I think are positive.
And sometimes that's when you can create your best work, when you get a client that might not really fit what you do or the publication, but then you apply like something really creative and you actually make it work. Like when we took Weet-Bix and made it work on broadsheet, that was like something I feared initially, but at the end I was really proud of it.
Absolutely. And just to close, I want to just leave you with a line from the article, another really beautiful one. Laughter expresses the absence of fear.
If you laugh in the face of fear.
Oh, geez.
How many Weet-Bix do you do?
Too many. So many.
Really?
I would do like, if I just had Weet-Bix for breakfast, I think I'd need to have at least 8 to be satisfied.
Ooh, I'm a 4-week Bix gal.
6. Look, we're covering the whole kind of spectrum.
Oh, look at us go.
It's configuration of my bowl. I get 4 on like going one way and then I get the 2 on the side. So it gets like that perfect circle.
That's a big bowl. Mine only fits 4.
Yeah.
But I do the multi-grain wheat Bix. So, you know, there's more nutrition every bite.
I think that'll do this for this week. Thank you very much, everyone. It is time for drum roll, please. The brilliant. Thank you.
Set the dog off.
There we go. Set the dog off. The brilliantly named thumbs up, thumbs down, maybe Shaka, maybe not Shaka. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and completely petty off of our chest. Lara, what do you got for us?
I'm going thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
It's been too many weeks of thumbs ups, and I'm done. Look. I've been on YouFoods, which is like foods. It's been like, I'm not here to give them a review. It's been fine. I'm eating less and it's pretty tasty and I don't have to cook. That's nice. Yesterday, I was convinced to bail on my YouFoods and get like something really delicious for lunch. And I was like, I chose really carefully because like this is the one time that I don't eat YouFoods. And I just ordered some pasta on Uber Eats. And it was damn tasty. That's great. I ate half of it. And then I was so excited to have the second half for lunch today. And I was like, I'm going to have double naughty lunch, but I've only paid for one meal. So it's fine. I went to heat up today and it was a cream-based pasta. And whenever you forget about this, you heat it up. If you heat it up a bit too long, the oil and the cream, like the fat, like separates. And so then my pasta was just like, there was like no cream. It was just sitting in this huge bath of oil. And I felt, I ate it anyway, of course. And I dipped bread in the oil.
It's a thumbs down to physics, basically.
It's a thumbs down to physics. And I was just so sad. I was so excited, you guys. And anyway, now it's back to tasty turkey rissoles with YouFoods. What about you, Em? What have you got for us?
I've got a thumbs up for a video series that I'm obsessed with at the moment. It's by Bon Appetit and it's called Gourmet Makes.
I
have you guys
love
seen
it?
It's so,
I'm
so
obsessed
good.
With Bon Appetit.
Yeah,
as it is.
Me too. So Claire, one of their pastry chefs, she creates like childhood snacks, but like gourmet version. So she just creates it from scratch and kind of works out how best to create it. So she's done Skittles, Oreos, Lucky Charms, Twinkies.
Oh, and you feel bad for her during them because she gets exasperated, completely.
She spends like 2 weeks recreating
full
Skittles.
On. I used one she's of these videos in an open tabs, in all the open tabs we did recently in Sydney, and it's just like, it's phenomenal. It's so worth a watch. The other series, just piggybacking off that, have you watched It's Alive?
No.
The Bon Appetit series?
Oh, yeah. No, I have seen one of them.
With
I
Brad,
saw him do,
Brad Leone.
Oh, what did I see him do? Jerky.
I'm so,
yeah, so good.
With him.
Me too.
Anyway, Jeremy, how about you?
I'm going to round things out with a thumbs up as well for another podcast. This is the Better Call Saul Insider podcast. So I don't know if any of you guys watch Better Call Saul.
No.
Well, you know, it's the kind of spin-off of Breaking Bad. And so every week they do a podcast, but it's actual Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, the co-creators of the show, with the kind of writers, editors, actors. They have like 8 to 9 people on every episode. And I think from a production standpoint, it's so fascinating. The story this season, actually, I'm not so interested in, but the amount of kind of craft that they put into like how they capture things, the work that goes into building their sets, like they are amazing, so detail oriented, things that you don't even think of while you're watching the show. And I just kind of, I love that they kind of, the people that they're giving kind of voices to that you don't ordinarily hear from in podcasts or in entertainment, but it's really kind of entertaining as well just to learn about these things. So I think if anyone here is into production or creative production as well, listen to this podcast. It helps it for you to see the show because it's like you watch the show and then they talk about all the shots and everything on it afterwards. So
that sounds really cool.
It's a really interesting kind of rich experience and another like kind of angle to the show. And you don't, like, you hear a lot of kind of, you know, fan podcasts and things like that, but nothing with the actual kind of creators, which is great.
Yeah, so totally. I love though that both you and Em gave like tangible things that the audience can go and and use. And all I've done is complain about oil, but I got to bring us down somehow.
Emily, where can people find out more about you online? What are the links?
Well, I've got probably just my Ingridipedia podcast website. I do have my own personal website, but I'm not in love with it at the moment. So just go to ingridipedia.com.au and listen to our podcast.
Fantastic. Thank you again so much for joining us. And yes, that's it. I don't have a good segue. It is so hot in here.
We are
losing our minds.
I have sweat dripping down my legs.
Oh,
my
God. Yeah. I'm with you.
Love is only. Now, to end, as we like to do every week, I am going to do a speed run of my outro. The time to beat from last week is
53 seconds and 41 milliseconds.
Okay, count me in from 3.
Okay. So we're going 3, 2, 1, and then you go, but I
do
won't
it.
Say go. Okay.
Do it.
three, two, one.
I'm Jeremy Wurtzman. She's Laura Tembaker. And this has been Jackie. What do you give to the business?
Nah, I started it from the thing.
God damn it.
Okay. Three, two, one.
I'm Jackie. Blah, blah, blah. Fuck.
Start again. Three, two, one.
I'm Jeremy Wurtzman. She's Laura Tembaker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out the stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter Gives You the Business, archives of all the shows and links can be covered on JackieWinter.biz. To receive all the links we talk about the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. You can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@JackieWinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us by subscribing, rating, and leaving a comment on iTunes, and of course, recommending us to all your mates, as well as iTunes. They can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the true listeners directly from our website, jackiewinter.qgd.biz. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to these using Podcasts, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see the links to our articles as we're talking about them, as well as other schmick visual content as we wrap it on. It's like we're there in the moon, right there in the room with you. And if you work for an advertising design studio, you're in a live enhanced version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.org for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Oh, that was a close call. You beat it.
I feel like I fumbled a bit. I was definitely tripping. It's not my best work.
Interest in giving the audience actual useful content has gone out the window because the information is gone. But on the plus side, 50 seconds and 16 milliseconds, you've done pretty well. You beat your time by like
It's just going to be a big slur next week.
Yeah. I don't know that it's that useful for everyone, but I'm really into the activity.
Okay. Well, to that end, we'll see you all next week. Thanks very much. Bye. Bye. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest, Emily. Okay, no, it's Naismith, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Sorry. I was
okay.
I kept going over in my head. I'm like, I'm going to fuck this up. I'm about to fuck it up.